What I wanted to do tonight was take a little bit of time just to look at the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. So I think it's really interesting, and I think in some ways it's very unique. There's a lot of prayers in the Old and the New Testament, right? There's some commonalities with many of the prayers. I think a lot of times when we study prayer, we really focus on the Lord's Prayer. And I think that's for a good reason. I think the Lord's Prayer is really amazing in terms of the level of theology packed into a few verses, right? The breadth of kind of what is being communicated in the Lord's Prayer. I think the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, though, is one maybe sometimes we don't spend as much time studying. But I think there's some very specific applications to us. And like most of the messages I ever give, it's one that I heard somebody else give that really made an impact on me at the time, where I thought, you know, I've never looked at this passage in that way of how is Jesus using prayer at this particular time in his life? And why does he do it the way that he does it? And what is the impact? And I think there's some conclusions you can draw from this episode in Jesus' life. And like I said, in some respects, it's a very unique prayer. And obviously, in some respects, it's a unique prayer because it's a very unique time in Jesus's ministry. You know, so background-wise, I think we're all familiar with it. But Jesus, you know, just prior to this, is anointed for his burial by the woman. We all remember that story where she's lauded as someone who is anointing him for his death. And then the Last Supper. So he gathers the disciples. He initiates the communion, the Last Supper. Judas betrays him. He leaves. This is the last thing Jesus does as a free man, okay, is the prayer in the garden. Immediately after this, he is arrested. And immediately after this, he is brought in, he is taken to trial, and he is crucified. So I think there's a significance to that. This is the last thing Jesus does before kind of that whole arrested trial crucifixion takes place. It's not a surprise probably to any of us that the last thing Jesus chooses to do before that critical hour as a free man is pray, is talk to God about what's about to happen. And I think the way that he does it is really very interesting. We all know that prayer is a priority. It's so obvious when you look at the scriptures, the idea of talking to God, how we talk to God, how we ask God, how we approach him. How we describe him, how we describe ourselves, how we ask him for what it is that we think we want or that we think he wants are obviously all very important. I think this prayer has some application to us. There's some application that really doesn't go to us. You have to be careful a little bit, I'm aware, with this prayer in that this was a singular instance with a sinless man who is going to the cross. Does that apply to me? In some ways, it doesn't, right? I'm not a perfect man. And so Jesus maybe uses a prayer. There's certain ways that you could maybe abuse this passage by making it say things that it doesn't say. But I think there are definitely, you know, why is anything in the Bible? Everything is in the Bible because it is, God has determined it's instructive for us, right? And we can profit from it. So this is his last free act. So what I want to do is just, since we have a limited amount of time, just kind of dive right into it. I'm not going to focus so much on the interaction with the apostles, with Peter, James, and John, in the interest of time. I really just want to focus on the three prayers of Jesus and what I think some conclusions that we can draw from that are. So if we look at the first set in verse 36, Jesus went to the place in Gethsemane, said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. So he's not doing this with the disciples. He's not praying with the disciples. This is Jesus and God. Okay. And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. So I think the first thing I want to discuss a little bit is his mindset going into Gethsemane is he is greatly troubled. Jesus is sorrowful to the point of death. I think that paints a vivid picture, doesn't it, of the level of anguish that Christ is experiencing here as he is preparing to go to the cross. He knows what's coming. He knows it's imminent. He knows that the next thing that is going to happen is I am going to be arrested. I'm going to be unjustly tried. I'm going to be condemned. I'm going to be beaten. I'm going to be ridiculed, humiliated, and ultimately I'm going to die. And I think that sometimes we overfocus, I think, on the physical anguish of the cross or the scourging or the crown of thorns. But I think one of the images to me that I think you get at Gethsemane is that I think you make an argument that even greater than the physical is the burden, the spiritual burden that Christ is going to bear. The burden of the punishment for the sins of the world, the sins of you and I. And ultimately, we remember that statement from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? That really communicates this idea of kind of the level of anguish, the level of punishment that Jesus had to endure. So I think he says this, I'm going to pray. I am sorrowful to the point of death, which I assume means I'm so sorrowful, it's kind of just short of dying, which I don't know if you've ever felt like you were that in anguish or sorrowful, but that's Jesus's kind of mental state at this point as he's stating it. Going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. I think this is fascinating, a fascinating statement. You know, sometimes I think we become overly familiar with passages, and so they're not as, I don't know if you'd say shocking or something like that when we read them because we've heard them our whole life. You know, Jesus is basically saying here, what is he saying? My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. What is he talking about there? He is talking about what is coming up. Now, like I said before, you can get in trouble with passages like that if you say things like Jesus was looking for a way to subvert the cross, or Jesus didn't necessarily have to go to the cross, or Jesus knew this was the plan of God. It was foreordained from the creation of the world. But he is also making this statement, isn't he, of my Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. But then he adds that second clause that's going to be so critical, right? Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And I think one of the things that I'll talk about as we go on is, to me, that is the critical clause in all three of the prayers. This is kind of Jesus's ultimate act of submission to the Father, of the submission to God's will. So let this cup pass from me, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Okay, so then he says in verse 40, and he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, so you could not watch with me 1 hour. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. I think another passage that's really interesting to look at in the parallel accounts of the prayer at Gethsemane is in Mark. If you want to turn over there, Mark 14. There's something that's not included in Matthew's account after the first prayer. Mark 14, verse 36. And you can see that this is in Mark's account, this is after the first time he goes and prays. All things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. Actually, where was I looking for? I'm sorry. That was a... So with you, everything is possible. It's a little bit different wording. Or, all things are possible for you. Also in Luke 22, the parallel passage that I think is very interesting, with something that's not included in Matthew's account in verse 43. After the first prayer, he says, Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And there appeared to him an angel from heaven strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat became like great drops of blood falling from the ground. It's really, again, kind of interesting. It's not in the other Gospels. So one of the things that's interesting is God answers Christ's prayer in a sense, right? He sends an angel to strengthen him. He doesn't send an angel to say, I will remove this cup from you, for example, right? He doesn't change the plan, and of course the plan is not going to be changed, but he does respond to Christ in the sense of strengthening him. Okay, so he sends an angel to strengthen him, and then you've got this interesting sweat becoming like great blood drops of blood falling down to the ground. You know, I was reading a commentary on Zechariah that I think made some very interesting points that I never thought of with this passage of sweating great drops of blood. And he was making the point that I think is valid. If you remember in Genesis, right, what is the curse that's put on Adam for the fall, for his sin? It's that he's going to have to toil. It is no longer going to be like the Garden of Eden, where there's bounty and you don't have to work very hard. Now you are only going to be able to live, to survive through the sweat of your brow. And that's the specific term that's used, right? The thorns and the thistles are going to require you to exert yourself in ways that you did not have to in the Garden of Eden. He goes on and curses, curses the female and the serpent. But that's the curse of Adam. And that is recurringly the curse that occurs, is that curse of toil, the curse of labor, and the curse of frustration. It's interesting because there's a parallel to that, right, in Exodus 39, where when they're setting up the priesthood in Exodus 39 and verses 27 through 31, I find this fascinating, that it's describing Aaron's garments and his sons. And we all know Aaron was the priest. Moses was the prophet. So 27, I'm not going to read the whole thing about kind of all of the setup that they had. But 27, they also made the coats woven of fine linen for Aaron and his sons, and the turban of fine linen, and the caps of fine linen, and the linen undergarments of fine twined linen, and the sash of fine twined linen, and of blue and purple and scarlet yarns embroidered with needlework. And the Lord had commanded Moses, as the Lord had commanded Moses. They made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold and wrote on it an inscription, like the engraving of a signet, holy to the Lord. And they tied it to a cord of blue to fasten it on the turban above, as the Lord had commanded Moses. If you did or didn't know that, so the high priest had a gold plate on the forehead of his turban on which it was written, holy to the Lord. Now we all know what holy means. What does it mean? It means separate. Why does the high priest, why does a priesthood wear linen? They wore linen because linen was a fabric that didn't make you sweat. It was an image of the reversal of the curse of sweat, of work. And that foreplate is kind of the same thing. Adam, you are cursed with the sweat of your brow. The high priest is ministering holy to the Lord. I think it's not coincidental that in the garden, when Jesus sweats, he sweats blood. And I think you can see that as a type of the blood removing the curse, the covenantal curse of Adam, which is you are cursed because you're going to have to live by the sweat of your brow. Through Christ's crucifixion and his sacrifice and his blood, I think those aren't coincidences that they are all emblazoned on the forehead. So anyway, that was a little side issue, but one that I find very meaningful and interesting. So we're going to go for the second incident where Jesus prays, picking it up in Matthew 42. Again, for the second time, he went away and he prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass until I drink it, your will be done." And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So it's interesting. What's the difference between the first and second prayers? First and second prayers are very similar, right? But they're not identical. In the first prayer, he's asking, "If it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." The second prayer, he's saying, "Father, if this cannot pass, unless I drink it, your will be done." There's a change in wording that I think reflects a change in approach. I think in the first instance, Jesus is actually asking God, "If it is possible, if it is consistent with your will, may this cup pass from me." In the second, he is not asking anything. He's saying, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." I don't think it's too much conjecture to say that there's almost an air of recognition. The angel came and ministered. He strengthened me. This is God's will. I know it's God's will. And so if this cannot pass unless I drink it, then your will be done. And he is ready in that sense. He returns to the disciples. They are continuing to fail. So he says, again, he came, found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. So the third time he prays, what does he do? He says the same thing he said the second time. He doesn't say the same thing he said the first time. He says the same thing he said the second time. My Father, if this cannot pass, unless I drink it, your will be done. We all know that three is a very biblical number. It's the number of the Trinity. It's associated with God. But I don't think it's just for that reason that he prays the same thing the second time, which is the total of the third time that he prays about this. I think it's more of what happened in the second prayer. Okay, this is where we're going. I'm ready to go. And Father, if it can't pass until I drink it, your will be done. To me, the most fascinating part of this whole passage in some respects is in verse 45. When he comes back, what is the picture that you get? He comes back, they're still asleep. He says, look, sleep later on. The hour is at hand. The Son of Man's betrayed into the hands of sinner. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. To me, and I think this is a statement where Jesus is rising to meet the challenge that is coming at him with eagerness. Okay, initially, he is in agony to the point of death. And that's not to say that he is not resolutely on the path to the cross. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that. But I think that what Jesus has done with his prayer here is he started off expressing kind of his agony, his desire that the cup pass from him, if it is at all possible. And through the way that he prays with God, the way he communicates with God, and the way he is strengthened with God, in that final statement in verse 45 and 46, we can see almost that if you got a visual picture, it would almost look like Jesus comes by, they're sleeping here. He says, get up. He doesn't even stop walking. He's ready to meet Judas. He's ready to meet his betrayers. He's ready to meet all of the things that are coming at him in the biggest trial, in a sense, of his life. Now, he's perfect. He has been tempted. He has overcome temptation. But I think in one hand, at Gethsemane, he has passed such a great temptation, which what would the temptation have been? To say, I don't want to do this. And I Jesus would never say this, but to say, I'm not going to do this, right? And Christ says, look, I'm ready. Let's go. Let's meet my betrayer. And ultimately, I think it doesn't say this, but let's go to the cross. I think his approach through the prayer has resulted in eagerness for the cross and where he is going and that his prayer. Now, how can this apply to us? You can say, well, I'm not going to be crucified in all likelihood, right? Probably none of us are going to be crucified. And again, I said, you have to be careful how you can apply this to your life. But I do think there's a lesson there in terms of when I have challenges, maybe when I especially have the challenge to do the right thing, in a way that's uncomfortable, in a way that I don't want to, in a way that I'm reluctant, in a way that maybe for me the temptation is to say, I'm not going to say what needs to be said, or I'm not going to do the right thing because I don't want to stand out, or I don't want to be the weirdo, or I don't want to be the person who is against the crowd. And I think sometimes, as we all know, when we approach God, we are reluctant to do what he wants us to do. In fact, frequently we're unwilling to do what he wants us to do, right? And I think using that same process of talking to God and saying, you know, God, this is, I believe, your will, but this is not what I want to do. Is there another way, God? And I think, you know, frequently the answer is no, because it's the right thing to do, right? And I think that using prayer in that way so that for me, it's encouraging to think, can my prayer life get me to the point when I know that there's something I need to do, that's either the right thing to do, that I can get to the point where I say, you guys can sleep later, rise, let's go up, let's meet my accuser, the time is at hand. And to me, that's very challenging, because that's how we ought to go into all of the confrontations that we have and the decisions that we have to make every day and the social situations that we find ourselves in terms of, do we do the right thing? Do we do the wrong thing? And where do we draw our strength? Jesus obviously drew his strength from God in this situation. He was, I'm going to talk to my Father. I'm going to tell him, as so many of the great prayers do, kind of what I'm thinking, what my desire is. And like I said, I think the ultimate, most important statement that in some respects that he makes is, yet not my will, but thy will. It's not about me. It's not about what I necessarily want. It is submission to your will. So that was a couple things I think are important from the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay, so I'll say a prayer, and then I think we'll open it up to any prayer suggestions. So, Lord, we thank you for Christ's example. We thank you for his prayer. We thank you for how he models for us how we ought to approach sin, how we ought to approach conflict, how we ought to approach doing the right thing, doing your will. I pray that you can help us to be bold in those ways and to glorify you every day as we walk forward in our ways. Amen.